This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This is where Yaakov, as Leti's brother, on his return to go back again to his homeland, and send his brother gift, and they sort of decide to part company on good terms. And then it tells us that in that night Yaakov took his two wives and his two handmaidens and his 11 children, and they crossed the ford of Yabok, and he took everything across. By Mosa Yaakov Levada, they gave Ovid Ishimo Adonosa Shokhar. And Yaakov remained alone, and a man wrestled with him until the morning. And of course, the question is, who is the man that wrestled with him? We'll just see what happened. And by Yaakile Yocholo, and then the man saw that he couldn't overcome Yaakov, by Yiga Bechafya Rechel, he touched him in the hollow of his thigh, but think of Kafriach Yerich Yaakov, and the hollow of Yaakov's thigh sank, by a Ovkel Imo, as he was struggling with him. And then he said to him, let me go. This man said, let me go. It's all very mysterious. And he said, I won't let you go until you bless me, and so forth. Now, I want you to know what the explanation of that is. We believe, and we've discussed this on various occasions, that if it's already been taken, then I don't mind. It's already been taken. Can you hear from there that it's okay? The source of everything is spiritual. It doesn't matter what it is. And its source, its real source, is, so to say, at the footstool of the throne of Hashem. And it is only when it comes down to earth, which we call the Olam Asiyo, the place of action and of deed, it is only there that it is translated and transformed into the form in which we find it. And that isn't very difficult to understand. So we call that Hishtalshelus. There is a kind of chain effect from its very source until it, in its present form, that we have it, with which we are able to operate with it here upon earth. A nation also has its source, and its source is spiritual. A nation has its source, and the source of that nation is called the sun of that nation. The word sun means prince, but really it is a power, and there is a certain power that that nation has, and it influences that particular nation. And here we have a case where there was a struggle that went on between Yaakov and Esau. It was a struggle that started in the womb, that continued as they were leaving the womb, where Yaakov was holding on to the heel of Esau. It went through their youth to the extent that Yaakov exacted from Esau the sale of his birthright. It went on afterwards when Yaakov took the blessing and not Esau, and it continued afterwards when Esau was after his blood and wanted to destroy him. And that battle between Esau and Yaakov has never ceased, and the hatred of Esau towards Yaakov has never ceased. As young it was an attempt on the part of the power of Esau, the Sarshel Esau, to undo Yaakov. And the struggle was to weaken him and let him lose his strength. Now, the strength of Yaakov and of Yisroel, their strength is the Torah. And the struggle was to weaken that strength. That is what this story represents. But what I want you to know is that little piece, that every nation has got its own star, it's got the either power and the influence, and that influence influences the nation. And so we find that each nation has got its own language, and not only has each nation got its own language, each province has got its own pronunciation. And those are the influences. Each country and each nation has got its own culture. And the culture can be very strong. And the culture comes from the South. It is a spiritual force that governs it and controls it to some extent. Now, once I've dealt with that, we are ready to begin our shiur today. And our called the shiur today, Events in Israel, Our Understanding and Response. Now, what is happening in Israel is something that disturbs each one of us, and what is happening is really, to some extent, beyond our understanding. But I would like to understand it in terms of Torah and in terms of Chazal. And first of all, we must know that the Chazal speak about Ikvasa de Meshicha. And Ikvasa de Meshicha, says Rashi, it is when the end of the exile, the Golus, is drawing near. And it is before the coming of Moshiach. That is Ikvasa de Meshicha. Literally, it means when one can already hear the footsteps of Moshiach. And we are told by Chazal that this will be a very difficult period. Now, you might ask, why do we believe that we are now passing through that particular time? And this has been accepted by our great authorities of the last 50 years or so, that they were saying that we are coming to that time, and then they said that we are already in that period. And the test is a very simple one, because the Gemara tells us what is going to happen in Ikvasa de Meshicha. And I remember when I learned it the very first time, to me it seemed so strange and it seemed so impossible that I just glossed over it. And I'm almost ashamed to admit to myself today that I didn't take it seriously. For example, it said that the method of negotiation would not be communication, but would be chutzpah, would be terrorism. That is the way people would negotiate something. It says that a mother will be afraid of her daughter-in-law, that a father will be afraid of his son. His son will tell him what to do. He won't be able to control his children at all. It tells us that the government will be an atheistic government. Now, it's not speaking about the American government, and it's not speaking about the English and French government. It's speaking about our government, that those in power will not believe in God. And it doesn't mean only Eretz Yisrael. It means that the leadership of the people of Israel will be in the hands of those who don't believe in God. Now, in my day, it was very difficult to believe anything like that. And one sees it's all coming true. It says there won't be a shortage of anything, that there won't be the money to buy it, because things will be so exorbitant. And it seems all so strange. And everything that it says, it's exactly as it says it's coming to pass. What I thought was something quite impossible, here it is, we are right in the middle of it all. And in all that it tells us, there were emes nederes. truth will disappear. There won't be truth. There are two pishotim for the emes, their teres. The one pishot is, as I've translated it, the truth will disappear. Now, I saw it coming many years ago, but even when I saw it coming, I could never believe that it would come to what it has come now. There has taken place revisionism, and now history is being rewritten. And how is it being rewritten? One of the things are, the Holocaust didn't take place, and this is now being written. Other things are being written, that the times were always as they are now. Now it's better, there's more morality now than there ever was before. It's not true that there's been a decrease in the standard of morality. And all this is being rewritten now. I saw a documentary on the screen of Montgomery. Now this is a period that I lived through, and I've got some intimate connection with it. And it starts off, the story is exactly as it happened. But gradually, and you can see the tendentiousness of it all, and you can see what the purpose is going to be. Gradually, the importance of Montgomery is minimized. Then it becomes such, he becomes a man that is somewhat of a caricature of a man. In the end, he ends up as a very small person. He's a nonentity by the time the film has finished. And this is a revisionism that is taking place. And here we find an expression of the emes nederes, and the truth is disappearing. According to others, the meaning of the emes nederes is not that the truth is disappearing, but it comes from the word eider, a flock. And truth is now being found in groups, each one claiming that it has the truth, that group has the truth, and no one else has the truth. So that is where it has come to at the moment. I want to concentrate this afternoon on that particular aspect of Ikvasa de Mashiach. Now, when it comes to the question of truth, we find that the question of truth is mentioned in Chazal very early. It goes back to before the creation. And the Midrash puts it in the following words. B'shor shebo HaKadosh Baruch Hu dibre es odem harishon, nasu malachei hatzorim ha'shorei titim titim chavuras chavuras. When Hashem was about to create man, he consulted with the ministering angels, with these forces and powers that he had created before, and they found themselves on two sides. The one side said man should be created, and the other side said man should not be created. So we find one power, and you must understand it in the context of those verses in the Torah which I read to you and I explained to you before I began this year. So one has Chesed said, when it came to a question of consideration, Chesed spoke up and said that man should be created, because he is a Gomer Chesed. He will be a person who will show consideration to others and show kindness to others. Truth said he mustn't be created. Emet said he mustn't be created, because after all he's Kudei Shekore. Man will be completely sunk in falsehood. Tzedek said he should be created, because he will do tzedokah, he will be charitable. Shalom, peace, said on no account is he to be created. Tekulei Ktoto, because it will be all dissension, it will be all quarreling. Don't create it. So on the one hand we've got Chesed, and Tzedek that say he should be created, and Emes and Sholem would say he shouldn't be created. Now, why they fall into two categories is quite simple. Because when one comes to Chesed, when one comes to Emes and Sholem, he mustn't be created because there won't be truth and there will be quarreling. When it comes to Emes and Sholem, it's got to be complete. You can't be a little bit truthful. It's got to be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. When it comes to peace, you can't arrange, all right, we'll have peace on Mondays and Thursdays, but on Sundays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we're going to fight. You can't have a situation like that. It's either peace or it's not peace. Whereas Chesed and Tzedek can be peaceful. A person can do a little bit of Chesed and it's Chesed. Another person can do more Chesed, it's Chesed. A little person can give a little tzedakah, but it is tzedakah. But when it comes to Emes Sholem, it must be there in its entirety. And therefore, those two factions said, on no account was man to be created. Now comes a very strange part in the Midrash. What did Hashem do? He took Emes and he cast it down to the earth. And then Emes may eret titzma, and the truth will grow out of the earth. It's an interesting situation. And what it means is that Hashem takes a darim, he takes a grain, a seed of Emes, and he casts it down to the earth. And the earth must mold that seed into truth. It must nurture it, and it must be molded into truth. And so, on the human level, what does it mean? That in every human being there is planted a seed of truth, something of truth in a human being. And the human being must take that truth, and he must, so to say, develop it into something that stands on its own. Now, I want to give you an example of it, of how it works. We find that God created man, and God created the world in which there shouldn't be anything for nothing. God gives man, but it's not for nothing. In the Shemoneh Esrei, in the first brocha, we say God is not an oseh chesed, he's not one who does chesed, but he's a gomer chesed. Now, gomer chesed means, gemilus chesed means, that it's reciprocal. If it's not reciprocal, it's oseh chesed. Hashem is not an oseh chesed. He doesn't do chesed, and one hasn't got to give anything in return. The chesed that Hashem does is for what we do here upon earth. And then we've got the chesed of Hashem. We say that man was created in such a way that even for his own perfection, as much of it as he's able to achieve, he's got to work and he's got to struggle for it. And that is why evil was created, that he's got this continuous struggle, and as he struggles against evil, then his reward is his own perfection. But to be born perfect, Hashem didn't create us perfect, because that would have been the greatest imperfection of all. The imperfection of getting something for nothing. So each man has got to work for it, and that is the kudus ha'emes. That is the truth in every human being. Don't want anything for nothing. Now, we find that there is a very strange phenomenon, and one can't help noticing it when one deals with human beings. If one deals with human beings to a tremendous extent, one finds that they fall into two categories. One helps the person, but helps the person to such an extent One puts him on his feet. One helps him to get married, have children, to be somebody. And then either he becomes very appreciative and remains so, and there is a love towards his benefactor, or the exact reverse happens. After he has received so much, he turns against his benefactor, but with such hatred and with such venom. What is the reason for it? If one studies it very carefully, you will find that the venom and the hatred is greatness towards the benefactor, where the benefactor has taken nothing in return for it. Hasn't taken a fee. He's done it all for nothing. There it is greatness. Because deep, deep down in the human being, there is this truth. And the truth is, if I get anything for nothing, it's not mine. And it's a bad situation. It's a low person who does that. And this person has given it to me. I hate him for it. This is the truth within me, that Nekudas HaEmes, that little bit of truth that rebels against that person. Now, there you've got the truth. You can do one or the other with it. You can nurture the truth into something that's very great, and there can be nothing but great love for one's benefactor. Or it can, you can deal with all, it gets almost rooted out. Man doesn't know how to deal with it. He doesn't want to know how to deal with it. And that is the way he reacts towards his benefactor. So the truth is there. God planted the truth. And he said, in here on earth, the truth is able to grow. Depends upon the human being, what he does with it. So now we see that truth was the one who won. Truth, God created man, and God created that Nekudas HaEmes. There is that little truth that is in man. Now, one can suppress it completely, or it can grow. So what we have seen, both things have been happening. And we have got the situation today where for Emes Nederes, the truth has ceased to exist. Very difficult for there to be truth. Man has not nurtured it. And on the other hand, it's been na'asis ne'ederis ne'ederis. You've got groups of people, and each one claims the truth. In Israel, you've got it in the political party. You've got it in the different expressions of what they call Judaism. And of course, what we are concerned about is that there is no absolute, that there is no unity. Indeed, there is a hatred between these different groups. And that is what we are examining. Now, there have been groups of Jews throughout the ages. If we will take that period before the outbreak of World War II, it's a period with which we are acquainted. You had different kinds of Jews. And I'm just keeping the map in my mind's eye. Starting from Latvia. There was Torah in Latvia. The Shimshkop was in Latvia, in Bosk. There was Torah there. Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Russia, Galicia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania. All those Jews were different. Was the difference of those Jews? How did they come to be different? you go back to my introduction, every nation has got its sun. And you can see it in the different nations. I used to wonder when I was in Eastern Europe, the difference that I used to see between a Lithuanian and a Russian. A Lithuanian, when he got drunk, he rolled into the gutter and he remained there until he became sober. When a Russian got drunk, he danced and he drank more than he ate and he said. That is what he did when he was drunk. The Russian was a very warm person. The Lithuanian was a cold person, very calculated. Those were differences that I was able to see there. Now, you had these different groups of Jews. And I'm not speaking about Jews who didn't keep. I'm speaking about Jews who were not only learned in Torah, but Jews who were steeped in Torah. And each one of these places had their own derech, had their own way of Torah. There was the Lithuanian derech, and there was the Galician derech, and there was the Hungarian derech. It was quite different. But there was never any quarreling that went on between the groups. Now you might say that it was because they were, geographically they were divided, and they didn't have to quarrel. But it wasn't so, because when they came together there was tremendous love. And sometimes they did come together. But there was Reb Meir Lugli. Reb Meir Lugli must have died in about 1929 or 1930. He died a very young man. He was of the Galician school. But the honor that the Lithuanian school paid Reb Meir Lugli, the honor that the Hungarian school paid Reb Meir Lugli, he was a giant in Torah, and it was recognized by all. He was the innovator of the Daf HaYomi, and the whole world accepted it, and this was before the war. The whole world accepted it. No question about a person like that. And then we go back to 100 years earlier, Rabbi Akiva Eger married the daughter of the Chassam Sofer. Rabbi Akiva Eger was the exponent of Lithuanian Torah. The Chassam Sofer was the exponent of Hungarian Torah. The tie that existed between the two, when Rabbi Akiva Eger came to Hungary, the Jews of Pressburg came out miles outside the town with a carriage. They came with carriages to meet Rabbi Akiva Eger, who was coming to Pressburg. And Rabbi Chassam Sofer himself was in one carriage, the leading carriage, going out to meet Rabbi Akiva Eger. When they came with the two met, Rabbi Akiva Eger got out of his carriage and got into the Chassam Sofer's carriage. The people in Hungary were so overcome that they had these two great ones there that they decided it wasn't right that horses should draw their carriage. They took out the horses and they themselves pulled the carriage. When they came to Pressburg, the carriage was empty. And they found that Rabbi Akiva Eger and some Sofer were walking deep in learning, discussing things, oblivious to everything that had been taking place. And they went to them what had happened. The Chassam Sofer saw that the human beings were pulling the carriage. He said, "This is for Rabbi Akiva Eger, not for me. I'm an interloper, I've got no right to be here," so he got out. Rabbi Akiva Eger said, "That must be for the Chassam Sofer that they're doing it. Can't be for me," so he got out the other side. So the carriage remained empty. But the respect that they had for one another, no question about it. Occasionally, young men from Hungary would come and study in the Lithuanian yeshivas. And there was a reason why they sent them there. They said that the Torah was so pure they wanted them to give them training in it. But they sent them there. There was no thought that they would keep them separately. After the war in Israel, all this has gone. Now, of course, the Jew is influenced by the country in which he lives. And so you find that in Lithuania, the Jew is very analytical in his study, in his understanding of the Torah. In Poland, slightly different. In Galicia, they are far more concerned with the length and the breadth of the Torah than they are concerned with the depth of the Torah. It's a different type of learning. In Hungary, there is a different type of learning. The Jews of all these places are different. The way they act in their prayers, in their synagogues, is different. And you take the German is very particular. Everything must be exactly as it's been handed down. And so in Germany, they were very particular about that. But I want you to know that in spite of all this, there was an awareness that this was happening, and everything was done to preserve the purity of the Torah. And what kept the people together, and it was one huge society, what kept them together was the bond of the Torah, and that I will explain to you now. And I want you to know that every couple of years, there used to be a conference, and it used to be mostly in Marienbad, in Czechoslovakia, and these, the Gedolei Yisroel, from Hungary, from Czechoslovakia, from Galicia, from Poland, from Lithuania, they all came together in Marienbad and spent several weeks together. And this was considered to be a very great event. But the censure that there was, differences, yes. And so we find that there was no uniformity, but there was certainly a unity in diversity. What is it that kept them all together? We Jews, as with everyone else and as with everything else, created for ourselves a framework. And that framework was the Torah. And in this framework we could move very easily. But as long as we kept within this framework. And so it didn't matter whether you were belonged to the Hungarian school or the Galician school, whether you belonged to the Polish school or to the Lithuanian school. It didn't matter, because it was all within this Misgeres, it was all within this framework. And then something happened. And here I must introduce something to you in parentheses. We've got a concept in Torah which is tumor. Tumor is a spiritual impurity. Now, there are several types of tumor, and this afternoon I will be able to deal only with one type of tumor. The greatest tumor that existed in one particular place in the old days was in Egypt. And Paro was called Paro from the word Pei-Rai-Rej-Ayin, Pora, which means to uncover, to break down and to uncover. And tumor is when one breaks down these boundaries that form the framework. And now there is no boundary left. And so if you have permissiveness, there you have tumor. There is nothing to deter anyone from doing anything. All the boundaries are broken down. Once the boundaries are broken down, there is tumor. And so we've got things like guilt. A person feels guilt very important for this framework. A person has got a sense of busha, a sense of shame. Very important for this framework. If you break down any sense of guilt, if you break down any sense of shame, person needn't be ashamed, nothing to be ashamed of. That is tumor. That is the greatest form of tumor. What has happened today in Israel and elsewhere is that we have broken down those boundaries which form the framework of the Torah, and we have created another framework for ourselves. In Israel, what makes it so difficult is that all these different schools and all these different peoples, and now we're not speaking about the those ones who are steeped in learning, but we are speaking about the followers. They are all put together in a tiny area, and they've got their own ways. They've been influenced, each has been influenced by the son of his nation, has influenced the Jews. But whereas before, the framework in which the Jew worked, doesn't matter where he lived, the Torah was the same. There was no difference in that. The language was Loshon HaKodesh. It was the same wherever he was. That was the bond that kept the Jews together. When it came to Israel, that was broken down. It's the tumor that came into existence in our own day. The breaking down of any kind of framework. But the Jew has to replace it. And it's been replaced in Israel by politics. And so, that is the guiding principle today. It's politics that decides. And you've got all these different people forming different groups, and they are in politics. The question is, what is our response to this understanding? I want you to know that although I have painted a dismal picture of what life is like in Israel today, and it's the same elsewhere, the only thing is that people have got more room to move about and to express themselves. In Israel, it's a very tight community. That in spite of the dismal picture that I've painted to you, there is another picture also. And that is that you still find individuals who live completely within the framework of the Torah. You still find communities that live completely within the framework of the Torah. You will still find yeshivas, although there are very few, that live completely and that function completely in a framework of Torah and not in a framework of politics. Just to give you an illustration, in the great yeshivas before the outbreak of World War II, and in the Lithuanian school, which was the Gaon school alone, there were 10 schools. And each school had developed its own way, and each school had developed its own derech, but it was all within the Gaon school. And the idea of the Gaon school was to have Torah in all its purity, that it shouldn't be influenced by anything outside. 10 schools all lived very comfortably with one another. So some of these schools became very large, and you had several people at the head of the institution. There was the best of relationships between the heads of the institutions, of one institution. You couldn't wish for a better relationship. not only was there a good relationship between the heads, but between the institutions themselves. We had a case, two of my best friends in Telge. One was the son of Rebbe Brudzinski, the Rosh Hashiva of Slabodka. The other was the son of the Ponovizhirov. Our Rosh Yeshiva sent their children to Slabodka and to Mir. And there was this interchange. That is how it was. Because the Misgeret, the framework in which one worked, was the Torah. There was no other framework. Today, it is known that there is considerable bickering going on between the heads of the institutions themselves. And then the students start taking sides. And it's a very unhealthy situation. All part of this, the framework has now become politics. On the other hand, we still have yeshivas where they work completely in the Misgeret HaTorah. We find communities, very, very few, that we find. We find individuals were completely in the Misgeret HaTorah. That is the only consideration. And it's easy, because we've all got it written down. If it's a question of an interpretation of a point, we know whom to ask, and we can deal with it. What is our response to a situation such as this? Now, I've mentioned it to you before. My uncle used to speak to us about it. And afterwards I realized why he used to speak to us about it. Because he was quite sure that we would live through these times and that we would have to handle it. And he said, don't fight. Don't fight it. And I understand now why he said don't fight it. Because once you fight it, you're in the same thing again. You're in the politics, where the Misgeret, the framework, is the politics. And he said, look after yourself, and after yourself only. And he said, if you are responsible for anybody, look after the person for whom you are responsible. Look after the people for whom you are responsible. Don't go outside of that. And you will be able to handle it. Once one goes outside into that, one is drawn into the vortex of politics. And that is our response. And what is taking place in Israel, we have nothing to do with it. They've got to work it out themselves there. As far as our people are concerned, those who work within the framework of the Torah will continue to work within the framework of the Torah. It is a force which one cannot fight against. And my uncle is quoted as having said there and left it at that. But he didn't. He added a corollary to it. And the corollary was, and that is the greatest contribution that you can make. By your example and by your effort in attending to yourself and to those for whom you are responsible, and not going beyond that, that is the greatest contribution that you can make. I know that there's some confusion about all that is taking place now. For what it is worth, that is my personal philosophy. Based on what I was taught. For what it is worth, I am imparting it to you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Again, when you are ready to see patients. All right, this is the thing.
Oh, I'm talking about two.
Two, right, you're talking about two. See, three is when you get face to face contact. If you are ready to see patients at 8 o'clock and no patients come to your statements or mine, you sit there for an hour.
Until 8:30 or 8:45, and then you come into the clinic ready to work. You found out over time there's no need for you to come in there at 8 o'clock because there's never a patient ready for you to see until 9. So if you've got other work to do, you do that. Then you check in. But if you check in at 8 o'clock and you're sitting there,
I read some of the early history of Israel, of Jewish Palestine, early, I mean, around the turn of this century. And apparently there was already there great dissension between the groups of Jews who arrived in Palestine, particularly German nationalism. The Germans, who were an important influence at that time in Jewish Palestine. From what I've read, wanted the country to be German. And any influence that would come from any other area, they were against. Now, I didn't read it in the context of Torah, so I don't know whether this was just was politics outside of Torah, or if this pervaded all of Torah Judaism?
Yes. Now, there was a very strong Torah element in Israel, and that has always been. So when Zionism started and Jewish nationalism started, there was a Torah element in Eretz Israel. It was very small. It was in Hebron, and it was in Jerusalem. Before that, it was in Sfat. But Sfat goes back a couple of hundred years. It goes back right to the 16th century. So I don't want to deal with that. But this was very strong in Israel, and it became even stronger as the nationalism. It wasn't only German nationalism. It was a Russian communism. And it was because of that that the kibbutzim started. And they started with a communistic idea. That wasn't the whole picture. There was a very strong Torah influence, and that was Chaim Yosef Zonnenfeld, Rabbi Zonnenfeld. He was a great fighter for Torah principles, and so even then there were these two frameworks in which they were working. One wanted Palestine to be a political entity, and the other wanted it to be based on Torah. And Herzl made it very clear when he started Zionism that this was purely political. And he used the phrase, rabbis to your synagogues. That's where you belong. Don't come into this. Wanted it to be purely political. And Zionism is purely a political movement. And that there is such a thing as religious Zionists. By the true Zionists, this is regarded as an intrusion. They didn't want this. The Mapai doesn't want this. They regard this as an intrusion. They don't want anything like that. They were completely in a political framework. Yes.
One, I'm not exactly clear. I think you touched on it, but I'm not exactly clear why the Torah world slipped into letting politics be its guiding principle. And two, I ask solely as a matter of history, not to get into any current situation, but was there this lack of conflict? Was there this binding of one group of Jews to another back in the Europe of the 20s and 30s, even between
Yes, I'll deal with both those questions. Your first question is, how did it come to this? How did the Torah world, so to say, leave the Misgeret HaTorah, the framework of the Torah, and go into the framework of politics? Now, it's Zeh L'Umah Zeh. It's part of what I touched on. God created the world in such a way that there is always the struggle between light and darkness, between good and evil, between truth and falsehood, between reality and illusion. There must always be that struggle. If there isn't that struggle, then it means that if there is no illusion and there is no falsehood and there is no evil, then it means that man is good and is born good, that there is no greater imperfection than the imperfection of having received something for nothing. And so man is really, in that sense, his own creator. And so it is with society also. There are these forces. These forces against Torah are greatest within Torah itself. The force of tumor is greatest in the Torah itself. And the Torah's got to struggle against it. It collapsed, it wasn't able to see it through. You understand what I'm saying? That is the challenge. There's always that challenge. It failed to respond to that challenge. Your second question is?
As a matter of history and not looking at the current situation. Yes. Necessarily.
Yes, I remember now. You want to know what was the relationship between the Hasidim. There was one very great battle between Misnagdim and Hasidim. It was against a particular sect of Kosim. And Vilna Gaon fought that battle, and he fought it on one basis only, and that is that in the Torah world there is the supremacy of the Torah, and everything else must be subsidiary to it. Whatever there is subsidiary to the Torah, and that is something to which the Gaon school has remained true always. That the reality is the Torah. That is the reality. Everything is subsidiary. There was great derech eretz towards the Hasidim from the Misnagdim, and from the Misnagdim towards the Hasidim. For example, the Tzanzer Hasidim, there was the Divrei Chaim, Reb Chaim Tzanzer. Reb Chaim Tzanzer was great. We use his works continuously. We work with it continuously, no question about that. The Geira Hasidim received the greatest respect. My uncle went, must have been nearly 100 years ago. Sefat Emes died in 1904, and my uncle was in his home. And I heard from my uncle that it was embarrassing. My uncle was a young man. It was embarrassing to my uncle the way the Geira Rebbe treated him. It was embarrassing to him. And he knew who the Geira Rebbe was. It was the greatest respect. There was a difference. That was, if any group of Hasidim or any sect put anything else above Torah, if they put prayer above Torah, if they put chesed above Torah, anything above Torah, that was fought. There must be the supremacy of the Torah. That is the reality of it. Everything must relate to the Torah and be judged in terms of Torah. Yes, Dr. Torah.
Would it follow from the paradigm that you made out that the religious parties that exist today, like Shas and Dago and whatever, should fundamentally be eradicated? That in effect, they should stick with Torah and let the impact of Torah work not through politics, but just as you described, through behavior.
That is my personal opinion. And I always qualify it or modify it by the words for what it is worth. So that is my personal philosophy. It only contaminates. That is tumor. You break down that misgeret of Torah. For the Jew, that is tumor. Let's get that. Still time for one or two questions. Yes.
We've talked about this before. At what point do you stand up and fight? How do you know that the difference is now becoming a breakdown in Torah rather than some minor influence of the local community? You've got big differences in the United States between groups of the Orthodox. I remember I had a discussion with you at one time about the insistence by the main body of wearing a black suit. And your response was that that's not something that we need to fight about. We go on and do what we need to do ourselves. But if you have to work within that body, then you change and you do what they want you to do. Now, this is not a change in Torah. I don't know, I can't think of the word that I want for what this change is. But what this means then is that gradually the body takes over all of the outer, the fringes. Everybody moves toward sameness.
To uniformity.
To uniformity.
Yes.
And if uniformity is not, at what point is it clear that uniformity is no longer Torah, but it's moving in the wrong direction? And now you've given in all the way, and now you don't have any outside influence that is pure.
Yes, you see, you've got the Chitzonius. The Chitzonius is the outside trappings of it. And the outside trappings, you've got to be careful not to confuse it with Torah. So, I've explained this to you quite often, that in the great yeshivas, nobody wore a black suit. It was considered to be improper to wear a black suit and a black hat. It was considered improper. The Rosh Yeshiva, yes, they wore black suits and black hats. They wore long coats. Because if there was a accord between their behavior, their knowledge, their piety, and the way they were dressed, we felt it would be improper. Unmarried, thoughts not always of the cleanest, never did a thing like that. Even those who wore long coats, very, very careful. Very, very careful before they wore a long coat. The great Edonir didn't wear a long coat. The great Edmotopar Romansky didn't wear a long coat. I've got a picture in my desk. It only got into my desk after you left, but not because of that. And I've got a picture in my desk of Edmotopar Romansky. Somebody in Cleveland sent it to me, got the picture, knew that I'd wanted a picture for Moshe Pogromansky. Moshe Pogromansky is wearing a yarmulke. Today, when you come to a wedding, you're supposed to sit in your hat. You mustn't put on a yarmulke. Nobody's taken a photograph with him as with a yarmulke on. These are the outside trappings. When you're living in that society, you do as they do. Can't help it. But I know any number of young men. I'm thinking of one in particular. I was at a bris recently and he was given an honor. He couldn't read the words. He had a given honor with the name of, he couldn't read the words. Wears a long coat and a black hat. And the people look at him and look at me and say, that is a rabbi. So what have we come to? What have we come to? The outside trappings mean a tremendous amount today. I see no problem there. There are problems in certain other things. There are problems. All right. Then, I've mentioned this very often. Whereas Abramsky once said to me, there was something I wanted to do, he said, don't do it. And I said, is it wrong? He said, no, it's absolutely right. He said, why not do it? He said, they'll annihilate you. Can't do that today. You just go along as you've gone along. A rabbi in New York, with whom I have a telephonic relationship, phoned me a little while ago. He had heard that I was at the wedding. It was mixed seating. I explained to him it wasn't mixed seating. It was a husband, wife, wife, husband, and so forth. So he said, yes, but you know, you shouldn't be at a place like that. I said, you know, I just don't understand it. I said, we never had this in Ethiopia. He said, that's impossible. I said, well, I'm telling you, this is a position. I know. Anyway, he left it there. 2 days later, he phoned me. He said, I've got to apologize to you. You were right. I found it was like that in Ethiopia. He said, but I want to tell you something. When Reb Aaron Kotler's son got married, that is the great Rebbe Kotler, Reb Schneier got married, and his son was his successor. He said, mixed seating, you're quite right. I said, there you are. He said, oh, just a moment. But when Reb Schneier's son got married, Malki Eil, there wasn't a mixed seating. So there you are. He's right. If that is the way, you have to accept it. You have to accept it. But does that make any difference to Torah? Does it need to say we're not even as Eretz or Torah? We don't share the Torah. When Reb Meir Lublin came to Frankfurt am Main, he was invited to Reb Yaakov Rosenheim's home. Yaakov Rosenheim, he was a layman, but a great layman, came to Reb Yaakov Rosenheim's home, and on a Friday night sat down to a meal, and after Kiddush was made and the meal had started, he said, I have something to say. And the Yaakov Rosenheim said, certainly, we want to hear your Torah. He said, it's not Torah, it's an announcement. He said, what is the announcement? He said, well, I live in Lublin, we don't behave like this. Men sit in one room on a Friday night and the women on another room. And if it's in the same room, there's a mechitza down the middle. Men on the one side, and women on the other. But I'm in your company and I do as you do. Now, he did that in order to cover himself, because he knew that it would get back to Lublin, that this is the way he behaved, and he would be in great trouble. So he explained himself on the spot. Okay, the Torah is different. Did he have any less respect for Reb Yaakov Rosenheim? Did Reb Yaakov Rosenheim have any less respect for him? Nothing at all. But when it came to politics, this is the way we do it. And this is our Rebbe, and we support him. But if he doesn't tell the line, then he's out. Then it's all together.
There is a real difficulty.
Yes.
In Israel, as in other places, there's a tremendous influence on the body.
Yes.
That the body politic is what controls the laws of the land and even the mores of the land, such that it controls marriage laws and kashrut laws and every other kind of law. And so the difficulty that always exists is, how do you work it so that there's some compatibility between the body politic and the spiritual requirement?
The way it was worked was always that there was a law within a law. There was a kingdom within a kingdom. In Eastern Jewry, in Europe, the Jews were an entity on their own. But even here it exists. We've got our own marriage laws. We've got our own laws of divorce. And we are within, we won't do anything that is against the law of the country. but we will work within the framework of the Torah, even here. So it doesn't really present a problem. But we've got that framework, we work in it, so we work, it's a community within a community, a society within a society.
It works here, but it doesn't seem to work in Israel.
It does, because in Israel too, when it comes to laws of marriage, laws of divorce, laws of inheritance, it's in the religious courts. Just one moment, I just want to give this. It's in the religious courts. And that is recognized by the state.
But the only way they can maintain that kind of influence is through politics. That's the dilemma.
Is it? How do you maintain it without any politics?
Because, by definition, there's a separation of religion and state.
In England, there's no separation of religion and state, but it maintains. No,
it's just basically the Jewish religion is just as you state, it's a separate entity.
That's right.
Within an entity. But in Israel, you don't have that.
One has.
You can't have it.
Well, it's coming to it. Now, if Aubrey Evans gets his way, and I can't believe he ever will, his way is break down all barriers. He says break down the national barriers. Let the Arabs take in the West Bank of these things and as part of Israel, equal rights. They're exactly the same as Jews. That is his theory. And in 50 years' time, you've got no problem. No Jews, no Arabs, only Israelis. So what do you think that the Torah Jew will do? He will still have it. He'll still be able to function. They function like that in America, they function like that in England, they function like that in Israel. It was Ben Gurion's wisdom, and only his wisdom, that saw you can't have laws of marriage, divorce, you can't have that in the secular courts. If you have that in the secular courts, you're going to have Israelis and Jews. And he saw the danger. And that was great foresight. So he, because it's a wonder, why should he have done that? He didn't want Shabbos. He wanted Sunday to be observed. He didn't want Shabbos. But this, there was no difficulty with this. This he realized it would split the Jewish people. But anyway, but it's worked. So you can be outside of politics. What you said is the argument of those who go into politics and say, look, it's got church. That is their argument. That is their argument. David, you wanted to ask the question, as everybody more.
What concerns me is that in Israel, there, since they are, at least biologically, Jews, so the tendency to infringe upon the religious Jewish sub-kingdom that you described is far greater than it is in England or America, where it's quite easy for the government to say, let them have their kingdom. The argument of the political religious Jew that Dr. Cohen is describing, does he now have a slightly stronger case in saying, we have to get into politics here where we were not in England or America, because they want us here in their grip in a far more intense way than they would in England or America.
I would agree with that. If it's necessary to fight, you fight. If they come into our territory, we fight. We watch our borders. We watch our framework. We watch our borders. We guard our borders zealously. We won't break it down from within. If from without there is an attempt to break it down, then we fight it. And we've got to fight it hard. And there is a wonderful description of that given obliquely in this book. It is called A Soul on Fire. A Fire in His Soul. This is a remarkable book. Its value is in the history, where everything is documented, everything given, its source is given for everything. And this, for example, we cannot, under any circumstances, accept conservatism and reform. We cannot accept it under any circumstances. And there is a little story there, just one paragraph, that Amos Grunemus put into the book, and it is about a friend of mine. We studied together, and this is Aaron Paperman. And Aaron Paperman became the executive director of the Teilt Yeshiva in Cleveland, and he collected tremendous sums of money. And he got a tremendous sum of money, continuously was getting tremendous sums of money from a conservative Jew in Cleveland. And then this Jew died. And they made a very big service for him in the conservative, what do they call it? Temple. In the conservative temple. And after that, was going to the burial ground. At the burial ground, the Aaron Paperman went up to the son to condole with him. And he said to Aaron Paperman, he said, I've looked round about the temple for you, and I couldn't see you anywhere. I want you to know that had you been in the temple, I would have lost all respect for you, and you wouldn't have got any money from me as the heir to my father's fortune. But now, I will carry on exactly as my father has carried on. And I had occasion to speak about that, and I said, I'm not telling you this to tell you the greatness of Aaron Paperman. That is the very least I would have expected of Aaron Paperman. To him it wasn't even a temptation. I want to tell you what Yehudah Thadoras means. That was a conservative Jew. Once upon a time, you won't get it today. That is gone. But the thing is to preserve that. We've got to preserve at all costs. And there is the whole account of how this was all being walked down, that conservative and reform is another expression of Judaism, and we've got to work together. It's all there, you've got it all clear. What Rabbi Kotler and about a dozen others and 10 others together with Rabbi Kotler signed a declaration exactly laying out what is the situation. There you've got it very clear in that book. Just worthwhile looking at. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.